It was the summer of 1996, and 26-year-old Sarah Smith had her whole life in front of her. Sarah was a young mother of two. She and her husband Dan were madly in love. They had a son and a daughter they both adored. According to family and friends, Sarah was just a very happy person in general. Sarah was also beautiful. She had blonde hair, big eyes, and a perfectly proportioned figure. But everyone has that one little thing about their appearance that bothers them. And for Sarah, that one little thing had always been her breasts. She thought they were a little bit on the small side. So just a few weeks after giving birth to her son, David, Sarah decided to treat herself. On August 25th, 1996, Sarah went into the office of a local plastic surgeon, 38-year-old Dr. Anthony Pignataro, for breast augmentation. Dr. Pignataro claimed to be a specialist in transumbilical breast augmentation. Normally, breast implants are placed above or below the muscle in the chest, but in a transumbilical procedure, the implants are placed through an incision in the stomach. Since the incision goes through the belly button, a lot of doctors say that if they do it this way, there are no visible scars on the breasts or under the arms. But it's a highly specialized procedure, and not that many doctors offer it. Dr. Pignataro had his offices in West Seneca, New York. He had started as a trained ear, nose, and throat doctor, then set up his cosmetic surgery office. And in that area, Dr. Pignataro had become somewhat of a minor celebrity. He offered tummy tucks, breast augmentations, and nose jobs. And he was a familiar face around town, where he drove a red Lamborghini. He was also an inventor. One of his most prized inventions was a system of snap-on hair pieces that could be implanted with screws in the skull. And not only did he invent this technology, he actually wore it. A lot of people remember seeing Anthony drive around town in his red sports car with his full head of hair blowing in the wind. On the morning of her surgery, Sarah arrived at Anthony's office with her husband, Dan. One of Anthony's assistants gave her pills, and soon she was feeling pretty woozy. The assistant led Sarah down to the basement. But over the next couple of hours, something went very wrong in that basement operating room. Sarah Smith had a heart attack. She was rushed to the hospital, and she later died. And she would not be the only victim of Dr. Anthony Pignataro, because it turned out that for years, Dr. Pignataro had been maiming and torturing patients, and he had a lot of other victims. What the hell happened in that dark basement operating room? And how was this doctor able to get away with this for so long? I'm Katherine Townsend. This is Blood Money. Now, if you listen to this podcast, a lot of you may know that I end up doing quite a few cases about doctors. I don't have anything against doctors or the medical profession. I think it's a profession that, like a lot of others, I'm thinking now of things like law enforcement, anything involving power. The medical profession attracts people who genuinely want to serve and help the community. But unfortunately, because it is a power position, it also attracts people who want to be in it for different reasons. It attracts a lot of narcissistic personality types, people who want to play God or are on power trips. Anne Rule, the legendary true crime author, wrote an anthology of true crime cases, and one of those volumes included the Anthony Pignataro case. It was volume number 8 of Anne Rule's crime files, and it was called Last Dance, Last Chance. Anthony grew up in Buffalo, New York, in an environment of wealth and privilege. His father, Ralph Pignataro, was a prominent surgeon. So, Anthony was raised going to expensive private schools, never having to work for anything. Everything was basically handed to him. His parents spoiled him. They gave him everything he wanted. He grew up believing that he was brilliant and special, and that he deserved the best. In 1978, he met Deborah Rago, who would eventually become his wife. Debbie had a very different upbringing from Anthony. She was born in 1957, and she grew up in a loving middle-class family. When she was 13 years old, her father, Frank, had a heart attack. After that, Frank became kind of a house husband and stayed home a lot to take care of the kids, which was very unusual in those times. Because of Frank's illnesses, the family had to work hard. Everyone in the family worked hard. Debbie always had a job. She was working in a local drugstore, and Anthony was in college at Lehigh in Pennsylvania. He was home in the area for summer when they met in 1978. Debbie was beautiful. She was 5'4" and about 100 pounds, so she was tiny. She had long brown hair and big eyes. Anthony was also a very handsome man, and Debbie was instantly smitten with him. It turned out that when they first went out, Anthony already had a girlfriend. But Debbie stepped up. She told him that she liked him and she thought he should break up with that other girl and date her. So Anthony did. He broke up with his other girlfriend. He started dating Debbie, and over the summer of 1978, they really fell in love. At the end of the summer, he went back to college at Lehigh. But in the summer of 1979, he came home again. He and Debbie picked up where they left off. Anthony did well in college. He was also a championship boxer. He was in a fraternity and he was popular. He had dreams of following in his dad Ralph's footsteps. Even though Anthony wanted to please his father, he actually had a lot of interest in the field of computer science, which was in its infancy back then. But in the end, he applied to medical schools. But maybe for the first time in his life, Anthony Pignataro had to face the fact that he could not get everything he wanted. He didn't get into any of the medical schools he applied to. In fact, he didn't get into any U.S. medical school. The only one that would accept him was the San Juan Bautista School of Medicine, a non-accredited school in Puerto Rico. For someone who dreamed of going to an Ivy League medical school, this was a major disappointment. But Anthony persevered and he went to medical school. Debbie stuck by him the whole time that he was studying. And Anthony got through his classes even though almost all of the curriculum at this school was taught in Spanish, so Anthony had to become fluent in that language, which he did. Anthony was a smart guy, but he always seemed to have this arrogance and overconfidence and never wanted to listen to anyone who would tell him to do things differently. After medical school, after dating for 7 years, Anthony and Debbie finally got married in 1985. She was excited to start their life together. He started his residency at a hospital in Baltimore. It was called St. Agnes. Debbie was crazy about Anthony. But a lot of Debbie's family members were not so crazy about Anthony. They said that they believed he was conceited and that he kind of talked down to Debbie and he seemed to be full of himself. Still, they went on and life was happy for a while. In 1987, they had a son, Raphael Frank, who they called Ralph. They later had a daughter together named Lauren. Eventually, they got a big dog to complete their picture-perfect American family. They called the dog Polo as kind of a joke because their kids were Ralph and Lauren, like Ralph Lauren. And to be honest, the family did look like something out of a Ralph Lauren ad. He was handsome, she was beautiful. They had these two beautiful children, the white picket fence and the dog. Anthony was always working hard, and whenever Debbie would ask him about work, Anthony would say that things were going great. But the reality was very different because after the first 2 years, when it was time for him to renew his contract, the hospital declined to renew it. Around this time, Debbie got an anonymous phone call from a woman. And to cut a long story short, she found out that Anthony was cheating on her. She packed her bags and she was ready to leave. She screamed at him and threatened him. But when she told him she was leaving him, she called her father and her father gave her some advice that would change her life and probably not for the better. Debbie's father told her she should forgive her husband, but only once. Anthony told her he was sorry, that he loved her, he loved their family. He promised that nothing like this would ever happen again. And again, Debbie was torn because she desperately loved Anthony. They had two children and she really wanted her marriage to work. So she believed him and let him come home. After the first residency didn't work out, they moved to Orchard Park, an area near Buffalo where Anthony was from. Anthony took a job at what was kind of similar to a walk-in clinic. Even in this early stage of his career, Anthony was making some very serious mistakes, including the time when he failed to diagnose an inflammation of the lining of the heart of one of his patients. This ended up leading to the patient's death. That family filed a wrongful death suit against Anthony, which was later dismissed. He went to Georgetown University and started another residency there. Over the years, he started to criticize Debbie more and more. He would say things like she needed to dress better or she needed to be thinner. No matter how much she dieted or what she did, nothing she said ever seemed to be good enough. And at the second residency program that accepted him, again, Anthony was making catastrophic mistakes. The other residents were talking about it. They thought he was arrogant and could even be dangerous. But somehow, he talked his way out of trouble and managed to hang on. One night, when he was on call, he went to a bar and got drunk. This was New Year's Eve, which traditionally is a very busy night for hospitals and emergency rooms. But somehow, he stayed in the residency. But once again, at the end of it, they declined to renew his contract. So he moved on again to Thomas Jefferson University. But again, Thomas Jefferson did not invite him back to complete the residency. And the other residents and doctors in his program called him dishonest, manipulative, and conniving. Even though he hadn't completed any of these residencies, and this happens so much in the medical field, what happens so often is that a doctor will be dismissed, maybe because the hospital wants to avoid malpractice lawsuits, or maybe the hospitals just hope that the doctor will move on and become somebody else's problem. So at the end of all this, what it meant was Anthony had done all of these different programs. He had spent years working, and yet he had not successfully completed even one residency program. This meant that he was a doctor with no hospital privileges. This could have been a major turning point in Anthony's life. He could have realized that he was making serious mistakes. He could have reevaluated his life, gone on to get different training, and been responsible, but he didn't do any of that. Instead, he decided to ignore what everyone else told him. He blamed the residency programs, never himself. In fact, he never took accountability for anything. He would blame anyone, his patients, his bosses, anyone he could to avoid responsibility. He believed he was smarter than everyone else. And he just went home to Buffalo. He opened a private practice there. Because he had moved back to his hometown, he was able to find a doctor there who was getting older and was not in great health. He started helping that doctor out, and he was able to get very occasional hospital privileges, which helped a little. Anthony set up an operating room in his surgical center. I'm using air quotes there because really it was a basement. His dream was to be a plastic surgeon, but his training was in ear, nose, and throat, and he had basically failed at even that. But he never stopped his research. He actually brought in female cadavers, and one of his dreams was creating a system of breast implants that would work like a bra. But instead of using implants, you would use wires, almost like an under-the-skin bra. He told a lot of people that eventually his technology was going to replace breast implants entirely. Anthony always had big dreams. The problem was the reality of what he was doing was very different. In 1994, he operated on a patient's deviated septum. This is a very routine operation, and I was horrified when I read what happened to this patient in Ann Rule's book. Anthony made a mistake. He accidentally cut into the outer layer of the brain, but instead of alerting anybody, Anthony just sent the patient home. This is very serious. This could have caused meningitis, serious infection, and even death. After people at the hospital found out about that, he lost his hospital privileges. But he continued to make catastrophic errors. Once he removed a tumor in someone's larynx and was just supposed to biopsy it. But during that routine operation, the patient's airway was blocked and the patient died. But Anthony didn't seem too worried about any of these errors. He said they could have happened to anybody. What he was worried about was, because he was a very vain man, he was worried about going bald. But he had an idea to fix that. He had an idea for a clip-on toupee that would never slip. Anthony believed that if this became mainstream, he could make a fortune. Anthony's idea involved four screws that were screwed into the skull. Now, this sounds like something out of Frankenstein, but according to Anthony, this would be a very simple operation. He said that you could drill into the skull with no problems for all kinds of operations. Then, a few weeks later, after the sockets fused with the patient's skull bone, you would screw a system of bolts into those sockets. After that, you could snap the hairpiece, which Anthony called prosthetic hair, into little pegs that snapped into the sockets. Anthony was so into this idea, he got his father, Ralph, to operate on him as patient zero. He wanted to try out the technology himself. And around this time, I don't know if a lot of you remember this, there was a company called the Hair Club for Men. And the guy who advertised it, so the guy's name was Cy Sperling, and he would do these commercials in the 80s where he would say, "I'm not only the hair club president, I'm also a client." And he would have this full head of hair. These ads were everywhere and they worked. So Anthony was thinking he could do a similar thing with a snap-on toupee. Anthony got a lot of media attention for this invention. There was an article in the Buffalo News. It read, quote, "The surgeon, who is married with two children, says he has never flipped his wig. Not while riding the swings at the Erie County Fair, not after diving into a pool, and not when he zips around town on his brother's Harley-Davidson motorcycle, end quote. Anthony appeared on shows like Mari Povich, Hard Copy. There were articles about the invention in the Chicago Tribune and the New York Daily News. Anthony told everyone this technology would cost about $4,000. And according to Anthony, it was easily reversible, just like getting an ear pierced. You could simply unscrew the snaps and let the holes close over. So during this time, it seemed like Anthony had this weird internal monologue going on. If anything went wrong, it was someone else's fault. He thought they just didn't have the capacity to understand his brilliant mind. In fact, by the mid-90s, it seemed like Anthony was going into full midlife crisis mode. He seemed to have the whole checklist. He had a lot of plastic surgery. He had cheek implants, he had a nose job, and he had some other surgeries. He had the snap-on hair, and he had the bright, shiny red Lamborghini. But Anthony was greedy, and he always wanted more. He decided that he didn't need the expense of an anesthesiologist. In fact, he didn't even hire a registered nurse for his surgical center. Instead, he had two assistants, a licensed practical nurse, or LPN, who had just graduated, and a high school student, a 17-year-old high school junior, to assist him in these surgeries. Everything about Anthony's office was a disaster waiting to happen. Meanwhile, at home, Debbie was taking care of their two kids, and she had no idea anything was wrong. Anthony always seemed to be busy, and oddly, a lot of his patients liked his kind of unconventional bedside manner. What Debbie didn't know was that Anthony was having another affair. This time, Anthony was sleeping with an exotic dancer named Moira, who he had actually done breast augmentation on. Around this time, Anthony seemed really fixated on two things: men who wanted more hair and women who wanted bigger breasts. After the disaster with the deviated septum where the patient almost died, the authorities in New York State were aware of Anthony. But even though he almost killed someone and inflicted horrific wounds on that person, somehow he was able to slip through the cracks. He decided to focus on the transumbilical breast augmentations, or tubas. In order to be proficient at this technique, surgeons are first of all supposed to be board certified. Then they go through specialized training that takes a week or more where they perform a lot of these surgeries. But Anthony decided he didn't need to do any of that. Instead, what he did was go and watch a couple of surgeons perform these procedures. He never did one himself. Then he decided to set up shop in his basement, and he started using patients as his guinea pigs. Since he had no anesthesiologist, he would give the patients a drug cocktail to put them under. He used a combination of sodium pentothal, which is better known as truth serum, combined with some other drugs. Then he would have the 22-year-old nurse, who, by the way, had no training in any of these types of procedures, and the high school junior assisting him. In her book, Ann Rule called the 17-year-old Tom Watkins. That's a pseudonym, but I'll use it here just so we don't get confused. Anthony paid Tom $5 an hour to help him out in his office. Sometimes he had his wife, Debbie, step in too. Anthony had no problem using her as an assistant, even though Debbie obviously had zero medical training. And there were other close calls with death. A woman named Terry Lamarty told the Oxygen show, License to Kill, that she was 39 years old when she went to get liposuction from Anthony. She described how very quickly this routine procedure turned into a living nightmare. She remembered going into the office and was given pills and water. Basically, that knocked her out, and the next thing she remembered, according to the show, was waking up later that afternoon. When she got home, there was blood everywhere. There was so much blood pouring out of her wound that her daughter had to soak it up with a mop. When she and her husband told Anthony about the excessive bleeding, he acted totally unconcerned. He told her to use a sanitary pad to soak it up, which they did, but the blood kept coming. When Terry took a closer look at her stomach, she saw to her horror that there were 18 to 22 staples and that the incisions were open. They had not even been closed. Then her stomach swelled up. She was in excruciating pain. Eventually, she and her husband went to the ER. The doctors told her that she had a massive infection. It was so bad that there was necrotic dead tissue on her abdomen. Doctors discovered that during Terry's procedure, Anthony had nicked her intestine, which meant, obviously, that her blood supply was being poisoned. Not only that, but these sutures that Anthony had put in her stomach were cutting off her blood supply, which caused that dead tissue. Doctors saved Terry's life, but she was left with a 4-inch hole in her stomach. One nurse made a comment that appeared in Ann Rule's book, and I'll never forget this because when I read it, it actually made my stomach turn. The nurse told Ann Rule that Terry's stomach looked like someone had cut it open with an old school can opener. Then Anthony showed up at the hospital. He took zero responsibility. In fact, he blamed Terry. He started yelling at her and yelling at staff. Then he grabbed her chart and started looking at it. It was so disturbing that the staff banned him from the premises entirely. And yet somehow, this man was able to go on butchering other people. Terry almost died. And it sounds crazy to say this, but doctors actually told her later that she was lucky because she survived. She had escaped with her life. Because Anthony's next patient, the young mother of two we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, did not. 1996 was the year when 26-year-old Sarah Smith walked into his office. As we said before, after Sarah had what was supposed to be a routine breast augmentation, she suffered a heart attack and her oxygen supply was cut off. She was rushed to the hospital, and when her family got there, they said that the doctor, Dr. Pignataro, seemed way too calm. When they asked what happened, he tried to put the blame on Sarah, saying she must have taken something before she came to see him, implying that maybe she took drugs, which was absurd. Then, doctors had to break the heartbreaking news to Dan that his wife, Sarah, was brain dead. And her family made the decision to take her off the ventilator. Sarah's family filed a lawsuit against Anthony for malpractice, and they won that case. And this was the first time, finally, that the case went beyond a civil matter. The police in West Seneca were very interested in what was going on with Dr. Anthony Pignataro. The police liaised with the New York State Department of Health. They talked to the nurse, the LPN, who they were shocked to discover had no idea what was going on. According to Ann Rule's book, she was trying to describe the operation and what had gone wrong to the detectives, but when they would ask her what happened, she would say things like, "He started cutting with that sharp thing." They had to remind her the name for the cutting instrument was a scalpel. The LPN told detectives that during the operation, Sarah had been moaning and she was in a lot of pain. So Anthony kept administering more and more drugs. He administered that sodium pentothal several times, eventually basically overdosing her. Debbie was in charge of reading the meter that went on Sarah's finger that kept track of her blood pressure. And several times, Debbie warned Anthony that Sarah's blood pressure was below 85 in the danger zone. Debbie told Anthony that Sarah's skin looked gray. She told investigators that she had told Anthony several times, but he seemed annoyed. He said that Debbie made a mistake, that the equipment must be malfunctioning. Eventually, though, the blood pressure alarm went off, and that's when Anthony started to panic and realized that he was dealing with an emergency. He sent Tom, the high school student, out to get an ambibag, because Anthony had no crash cart or other equipment in the office that could have saved Sarah's life. But Tom could only find an ambibag, which goes over the patient's mouth to open up the airway. He could only find one that was meant for a child. And while they're messing around trying to find the right equipment, Anthony realized he needed to open up the airway. And I find this actually really hard to read and to look at, but Anthony realized he needed a flat piece of metal to put into Sarah's mouth to open up her airway and realized he didn't have one. So he used a coat hanger. He was sticking a coat hanger into this woman's throat. Later, after the medical examiner examined Sarah, they concluded that if Anthony had had the things there that were required to be there, he could have saved Sarah's life. The cause of death was asphyxiation due to inadequate ventilation under anesthesia. After Anthony and his assistants finally called for help, even after rescue workers arrived, he didn't help Sarah at all. He was really overdramatic. He kept screaming, "We've got to save this one," like one of those dramatic doctors on a TV show. But he wasn't actually doing anything to help her. In fact, he was getting in their way. A lot of the rescue workers said that he impeded their work. Anthony had no ventilator. He had no anesthesiologist, no properly trained nurse, no EKG machine. But once again, Anthony blamed everyone else. He blamed the hospital. He insinuated and later flat out stated, maybe Sarah was partying and doing drugs before she came in his office, which was utterly absurd. Then he said there was a conspiracy theory against him, Once again, nothing was ever Anthony's fault. Prosecutors conducted an investigation, and according to forensic files, they realized that Anthony was not even board certified. In fact, he wasn't certified in anything. Not even really ear, nose, and throat surgery that he'd originally trained for, because he never completed his residencies. And multiple people stated, they said that this type of surgery, a transumbilical breast augmentation, should absolutely have been done in a hospital setting. And a toxicology report also concluded that Anthony mixed sodium pentothal and Versed. These are two different medications meant to relax the body, but the dosage that Sarah got was so high that she overdosed and she couldn't breathe on her own. It paralyzed her throat muscles. At that point, the New York State Department of Health suspended Anthony's medical license, and the Erie County District Attorney's Office took over the investigation officially. Anthony was charged with manslaughter. He pleaded guilty to criminally negligent homicide. But y'all, even after all this man got was 250 hours of community service, a $5,000 fine, and 6 months in jail after killing someone. Anthony did his few months in jail. He had lost his medical license, and when he was released, this time, he couldn't hide the truth from everybody anymore. And in addition to that, because his parole required that he stay in the same area, everyone in town basically knew what he'd done. He became the target of vandals. They spray-painted killer on the side of his house in graffiti. He claimed that he was getting death threats. And during this time, Anthony and Debbie's relationship started to fall apart again. Debbie had no idea that while he was begging her to give their marriage another chance and professing his love to her, he had started yet another affair. This time, it was a blonde woman who was in her 40s. She owned a cleaning company and had met Tony at the gym. But Debbie still loved her husband, and she was scared because people were targeting her and targeting the home, painting death threats on the side of it. She felt safer when he was in the house. So after he begged her, they got back together. This was in 1999, and disaster struck again because around this time, Debbie started having these weird flu-like symptoms. She had nausea, weakness, and vomiting. Doctors couldn't figure out what was wrong with her, and neither could Anthony, and it continued to get worse. She had numbness in her hands and arms, and her legs were so weak that she couldn't walk. Eventually, she was in a wheelchair. The doctors were stumped. They thought it might be Guillain-Barré syndrome. Anthony had his own opinions. According to forensic files, he told doctors that Debbie's gallbladder desperately needed to be removed, but the doctors disagreed with that diagnosis. Debbie would get better for a little while, and then she would take a turn for the worse and end up back in the hospital. Not knowing what was going on and having her husband there and feeling helpless, even though her husband was a medical professional, must have been terrifying for Debbie. Then her daughter, Lauren, started to get sick too. Debbie went back to the hospital again, and this time the doctor analyzed a bone marrow sample. He was shocked. He saw that her red blood cells had degenerated to almost nothing. And when he looked into what could have caused that, he realized he could be dealing with a case of poisoning. Specifically, he suspected arsenic poisoning. Arsenic is a very heavy metal, extremely toxic to the human body. Debbie's level, according to forensic files, was 29,580 micrograms per liter. One of the highest levels ever recorded in a living person. According to the show, it was basically a miracle that Debbie was still breathing, because 50 to 100 micrograms per liter could be fatal. So then the hospital, the doctor started asking Debbie how she could have been put in contact with arsenic. They asked her who prepared her meals, and of course she told them Anthony had been doing it. He had been making her soup and bringing it to her room. Now at this point in the podcast, as true crime listeners, we probably all know where this story is going. But the tragedy is, Debbie didn't. Or even if she did on a subconscious level, apparently she did not want to believe it. She told forensic files she could accept that her husband might not love her anymore, but she just couldn't believe that he would do something like that to her, the mother of his children. But the district attorney's investigators were convinced that Anthony had poisoned Debbie. And even though Debbie survived, she had severe nerve damage because of what Anthony did to her. She was told she may never walk again. She couldn't feed herself or even lift a hairbrush. And even though she was taking a lot of painkillers, she spent her days in excruciating pain. Prosecutors believed the motive was money. Anthony was running out of money. He had expensive tastes and an expensive mistress. He had taken out a $100,000 life insurance policy on Debbie. But that was just a drop in the bucket. Actually, what Anthony was more worried about was losing the financial backing that his mother was giving him. Anthony's father had passed away, but his mom had continued to financially support him and Debbie, even through all of his catastrophic failures. Without Anthony's mother's support, they never could have lived the lifestyle they were living. The problem was that his mother did not believe in divorce. Anthony's dream was to move from New York to Florida to start a new life with his mistress. He needed cash, but his mother had already told him straight up that if Anthony got a divorce, she was cutting him off financially and cutting him out of the will. So for Anthony, that was not an option. By now, of course, the West Seneca Police Department was extremely suspicious of Anthony. They took a hair sample from Debbie, since arsenic binds to the keratin in hair. And through that, they were able to figure out exactly when she had been exposed to that poison. They also interviewed Debbie's daughter, Lauren, and they found out that on the day when she started to get her symptoms, which were much milder than her mother's, she had eaten some leftover soup on the kitchen counter that Anthony had served to her mother. Debbie confirmed that Anthony was the one who made the soup and that he delivered it to her and insisted that she eat it. Lauren actually was able to get some of that leftover soup that was still in the kitchen and give it to doctors. After analyzing that hair sample, they figured out that Debbie had started receiving the arsenic in May of 1999. Then Anthony gave her a massive dose in the middle of the summer in July. That dose was 80 times what a normal person should have. But incredibly, Debbie survived. And later, doctors said the reason that she survived was because he had poisoned her with small amounts in the beginning. And actually, her body had developed a tolerance to arsenic. And it was only after all this, prosecutors were able to put together just how diabolical Anthony's plan had been. Not only did he poison his wife over a long period of time and watch her deteriorate and suffer, but detectives figured out that he had actually spray-painted the graffiti on the house himself to make it look like someone else was making death threats, so that later he could blame them. He could blame his victim, Sarah Sands' family, for the poisoning. He had been having an affair the whole time when he was telling Debbie that he wanted to come home and wanted to make their marriage work. He got himself back in that house. He got her to come back to him just so he could kill her. Also, doctors confirmed that if they had done what Anthony wanted them to do, if they had taken Debbie's gallbladder out, she definitely would have died. Now, for a case like this, the DA's office needed a lot of evidence. They did have a jailhouse informant, someone who had done time with Anthony, and said that Anthony had talked about poisoning his wife several times, and he'd said that he'd done it a little bit at a time. Normally, jailhouse informants can be a little problematic as witnesses, but this guy had a couple of things in his favor. First of all, the charges against him were pretty minor, so it's not like he was facing years behind bars. Also, the things he told detectives, dates, times, they all checked out. Detectives were able to figure out, again, through Debbie's daughter, Lauren, that Anthony had been setting out these small, round tins. They were insecticide. And detectives figured out that that particular brand of insecticide, called Grant's Kills Ants, did use arsenic. They found a nearby store that sold that type of insecticide, and they figured out that that's where Anthony had gotten the arsenic. While Anthony was in prison, he got involved in harder drugs, including heroin. He told someone that he was in jail with that he was having an affair, but he didn't want to go through a divorce. He believed not only would he lose all his marital property, but he would also be cut out of the will. But Debbie still believed in her husband. She was still clinging on to that last shred of hope that maybe everyone was wrong. Then investigators dropped another bomb on her. They told Debbie that while she had been at her weakest, lying there in the hospital fighting for her life, Anthony had written a card to his mistress, begging her to take him back. That was it for Debbie. She kicked Anthony to the curb and she never looked back. She went home and she fought to recover. Even though every day was a battle, she had to relearn to walk and dress herself. She was finally trying to keep her kids and reclaim her life. That's when detectives found Anthony's book, MD Mass Destruction. And the book is all about how he was a victim. And in addition to being badly written and referring to himself sometimes in the first person, sometimes in the third person, he basically says the whole time that people die sometimes during surgery. It wasn't his fault. And later, he actually sent the draft of his book to Ann Rule and a lot of other people. Prosecutors said they also believed that he could have been trying to get his medical license back by murdering Debbie, weird as that sounds. They thought that if the doctors had taken the gallbladder out and she had died on the table, maybe he would have been able to say, look, I was right. People do die sometimes during surgery. It wasn't my fault. That's how narcissistic and out of touch this man was. Anthony was charged with attempted murder. He pleaded guilty to attempted first-degree assault. And it was interesting because according to forensic files, this was one of the first known cases of arsenic poisoning that only had one victim. Because previously, investigators believed arsenic poisoning, it was something they kind of linked to black widow killers, women who entrap men and have multiple victims. Debbie wrote a letter to the judge. It was quoted in Ann Rule's book. In that letter, she wrote, quote, "He always told me how lucky I was to have him. He degraded me in front of people. He often said, look at yourself, who would want you? He made me cry all the time," end quote. She talked about how much pain she was in, but she said despite the pain, she was grateful to be alive. She was grateful to have her kids and to know it was important and to have that psychopath out of her life for good. She said, quote, "I do not feel safe with this man on the streets," end quote. In the end, Anthony got a 15-year prison sentence. He served his time at the Five Points Correctional Facility in Romulus, New York. To this day, Debbie continues to suffer physical damage, and she still wonders how he could have done this to the mother of his children. She told the show Forensic Files, a fair punishment would be if Anthony was forced to take arsenic himself. Debbie eventually legally divorced Anthony. In December of 2013, Anthony was released. And finally, he went to Florida. 3 years later, he legally changed his name to Anthony Haute, H-A-U-T-E, and he started advertising himself as an elder care provider. Because apparently, you don't have to be a doctor to be an elder care provider. The New York Times reported that Sarah's death ignited a controversy over what doctors should be allowed to perform cosmetic surgery procedures. Because technically, the newspaper pointed out that any licensed doctor can perform surgery. A lot of cosmetic procedures like tummy tucks, liposuction, breast augmentation are done in doctor's offices in these surgical centers rather than hospitals. Because the surgical centers are much more unregulated than the hospital environment, there is a need for patients to be very informed about what's going on. Anthony had licenses hanging all over his office that said he was board certified. We're going to talk some more in tomorrow's bonus content about how to verify that doctors are properly certified. And I cannot stress enough how important this is. Because even though these procedures are advertised sometimes as lunchtime lipo, these are surgeries and they have very real risks and consequences. At the end of Ann Rule's book, I remember she said that Anthony would be nearly 60 when he got out of prison. I remember that when I was in my early 20s, that sounded elderly. But in today's world, where 60 is the new 40, especially for a handsome anti-aging doctor, I started to wonder about Anthony and where he is now. It turned out that after he got released from prison and headed down to Florida for a fresh start, he continued to misrepresent himself. He founded a company called Tony Haute Cosmetique LLC. The news station tracked down his home near West Seneca. They said he wasn't there, but neighbors had called the police on him before, quote, after noticing packages of surgical supplies being shipped to the address and observing women coming and going from the apartment late at night. As one neighbor put it, some real strange stuff happens here, end quote. After the story came out, the website disappeared. Anthony responded to WKBW's report. He said he'd apologized to his ex-wife and the Smith family and said that he worked as a delivery driver. But in August of 2020, another station, this time in South Florida, tracked him down. The reporter, Channel 7's Brian Enten, approached Anthony and asked him why he was calling himself a doctor again. Apparently, what had happened was that a guy named Sid Klein had tipped the news channel off after saying that he met with Tony. Tony told him that he was looking for someone to market his new skincare line. And on the website advertising that skincare line, Tony was wearing a white lab coat. He said he was a doctor and a scientist. And he referred to the stuff he was selling as DNA-based plasma protocol. It all sounded very scientific and legit, but of course was a total scam. The Erie County District Attorney told the news channel that putting the word doctor on his website would have been illegal in New York, but in Florida, apparently it was allowed. Even with no medical license, because Anthony has a medical degree, he can call himself a doctor in Florida. So I hope that if Anthony is still out there, everyone in Florida, where a lot of my friends and family live, are aware of this man and are looking out for him. Because this man is out there, he is dangerous, he's obviously learned nothing, and I would hate to hear about another victim being led down to Anthony's dark basement. I'm Catherine Townsend. This is Blood Money.